And they also asked me if I could just let all of you know that we not only have an open forum for skeptics 4 times per year in this facility, we also have one in the University Club in downtown Pasadena. We do that 6 times a year at lunchtime. It's a little bit tricky. You got to buy a lunch to come, but that's the way it is. And that's proving to be sufficiently popular that I'm recruiting Dr. Fuzz Rana and Ken Samples from Reasons to Believe, our biophysicist and a philosopher, if we can make that 12 times a year. So I'll do half of them. They will do the other half. So there'll be other opportunities to do this. And also we have a group in Orange County that will be launching a similar opportunity. So this is six. And by the way, we have, through Reasons to Believe, open forums for skeptics in several cities across the country now. So this is something that is growing in demand and popularity. I'd like to begin with a little thing I picked up here. It says, a teacher asked a student to sum up Socrates' life in 4 lines. And here's what he said. Socrates lived a long time ago. He was a very intelligent man. Socrates gave long speeches. His friends poisoned him. So, one of the ways that we launched this open forum for skeptics is to encourage people like myself to be brief in their introductory remarks and really make it an open forum. But we always have discovered that it helps to have some introductory remarks just so that people who have no familiarity with us got some idea of what our background is and the kinds of questions that we would be prepared to field. And so it's become a tradition that we open it up with some kind of discussion of a brand new scientific discovery that would be giving additional evidences for the God of the Bible. So I'm going to start off with one, but I'm also going to try to fulfill a request. Last Sunday in this church, I did something very foolish. I tried to condense our creation model down to about 35 minutes. Zipped all the way through it, and people were telling me they were getting writer's cramp and all that kind of stuff. So, but I had that request after each service, is if I could give a little review this morning on the various scientific limitations on the length of time that humanity could survive here on planet Earth. So I'm going to try to do that as well, but I'll be quick, following the advice of this young student. Okay. A friend of mine by the name of John Cormody, interesting fellow, he was a year behind me in my high school, wound up going to the same University of British Columbia for a physics degree, and then I went out on to the University of Toronto to study astronomy. I discovered that he indeed enrolled at the University of Toronto, got his master's and PhD in astronomy just like I did. I went to Caltech, and he was right there next year at Caltech as well. He's now at the University of Hawaii. And he's an optical astronomer. I've been a radio astronomer. But it's just been fun, from my perspective, watching his career develop over the past couple of decades. And he's responsible for what I would consider to be a significant discovery that helps establish the creation model for the universe. And that has to do with the fact, remember I was sharing here, I think it was the last open forum for skeptics, I discussed how there was a new discovery based on supernova eruptions that demonstrated that the universe had to be exquisitely fine-tuned both in its mass density and in its cosmological constant. In fact, it proved to be the most profound design evidence ever discovered by astronomers. In fact, I think I've got the paper right here if you're interested. Yeah, here it is. This one by 31 astronomers called the Supernova Cosmology Project. And the bottom line is that in order to explain the stars, the galaxies, the planets, and the moons that are necessary for life to be possible at any time in the history of the universe, you have to fine-tune or design the value of the mass density of the universe to better than 1 part in 10 to the 60th. That's with 60 zeros after the 1, and the value of the cosmological constant to better than 1 part in 10 to the 120th. That's 120 zeros after the 1. And indeed, the authors are correct in saying this is the most significant or profound design evidence ever uncovered. It is so profound that it establishes that the creator of the universe is, what did I say last week, 10 trillion, 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 trillion times more intelligent, more knowledgeable, more creative, and better funded than the best designers that we human beings can come up with. But what John Cormody has contributed is this. For a long time, we've had the capacity to measure the total mass of the universe. And it comes in at about 28% of the mass that would be necessary to bring the expansion of the universe to an eventual halt. And, you know, 28% is the latest measure, and now we have it down to two places of the decimal, whereas a year ago it was like one place of the decimal. So we have that pretty well accurately pinned down. We also have accurately pinned down the quantity of visible matter in the universe. And what you do is you figure out that the quantity of dark matter in the universe would be the total amount minus the visible amount. Now, where John Cormody comes in is he's found a way to directly measure almost all of this missing matter in the universe. And he's discovered that it resides in a very unlikely place. Astronomers have been looking for this missing dark matter in the giant galaxies. And John decided to have a look in the tiny galaxies. And what he discovered is that these little dwarf galaxies, and by the way, there's about 10 or 20 dwarf galaxies for every galaxy the size of ours or bigger. They're very numerous in the universe. And John discovered that it's inside these tiny galaxies, these dwarf galaxies, that we'll have a whole lot of this invisible matter. And he also was able to develop in his paper the physical reason why. The smaller the galaxy, the less capacity that galaxy has to convert gas and dust into stars. You know, once they're converted into stars, you can see the stuff. But if they don't get converted into stars, it remains dark and invisible. And he says, and the problem with the dwarf galaxies is they're just too small in order to generate the kind of coagulations under the force of gravity that would produce a lot of stars. And so all these dwarf galaxies you see out there are loaded with all of this gas and dust that's never been converted into stars. And his calculations demonstrate that the quantity of this stuff is enough to almost totally account for all of these, this missing dark matter. It also explains something else that astronomers have been observing for the last 15 years. Namely that when a galaxy our size or bigger swallows up a dwarf galaxy, you get this sudden burst of star formation. In fact, I think we've shown some slides here previously of these so-called starburst galaxies. And what a starburst galaxy is a galaxy like ours that winds up sucking in one or two dwarf galaxies inside of it, and that ignites this explosion of new starburst. Well, why does that happen? As John Cormody has pointed out, these things are loaded with gas and dust that's never been exploited for star formation. And one of the big galaxies sucks in one of these dwarf galaxies, that gas and dust now gets efficiently transformed into new stars. So is that ever going to happen to our galaxy? Yes, it's in the process, for example, of dragging into its core the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's going to take, you know, a few more billions of years, but eventually that will happen, and there will be this new burst of star formation when that takes place. Well, the Large Magellanic Cloud is a little bit big compared to other dwarf galaxies, so it won't be quite the dramatic impact we see elsewhere. But bottom line, what this establishes is that we not only can detect the total amount of matter and the visible matter, we're now in a position to detect the stuff that's been called dark and invisible. And it kind of neatly ties the ribbon and says we really understand what's going on with the total mass of the universe and its different component pieces, and therefore we can have confidence in the measurement that these 31 astronomers produced, that indeed we're looking at a mass density of 28%, which must be fine-tuned to within 1 part in 10 to the 60th, or we would never have the planets and the stars that are necessary for life. Okay. And one of our succeeding issues of Facts for Faith, that's our new magazine. The old one was called Facts and Faith. We're now going to Facts for Faith. And the difference is, instead of being just 16 pages, this will be 48 pages, four color, and we're going to be able to talk to you about a lot more of these discoveries that are taking place. You know, and Tom was saying, you know, like every day we get a new discovery that helps strengthen the evidence for the God of the Bible. Well, this little bibliography that we've been producing, it really adds up to about 600 discoveries per year. But just yesterday, I picked up the latest issue of Science and went through it, and I had to tick off 12 separate articles, each of which would be documenting new evidences for the God of the Bible. And this is just one of 15 different journals that we survey, and there's 12. And by the way, on the cover is an interesting little thing. That's the latest from the Hubble Space Telescope, and it shows a gaseous nebulae where in one photograph you can see every single stage of star formation going on. Okay, so that means we have a photograph that literally shows the whole panoply of stars going from just amorphous gas clouds down to stars that are burning by nuclear fusion. So it's wonderful to see the whole sequence. And that, of course, helps us have greater confidence in our theories of star formation. And incidentally, this also helps resolve a controversy within the Christian community. You know, there are Christians who actually believe stars don't form today based on a misinterpretation of Hebrews 4:3. You read Hebrews 4:3 and it talks about the work of God being finished, and certain Christians overinterpret that to say that, well, everything, therefore, must be finished. When in fact, if you read the context, it's talking about the work of redemption that Christ did as being finished, rather than the fact that nothing in the creation is happening. I don't know what they would do with raindrops that are forming, but in either case, we know that's not the case. All right. I said I'd spend a few minutes to answer a question that came up last week. What are the factors that would hasten the demise of humanity? Okay, what I'm going to do is there's eight things here on my list. I'm going to start with those things that are absolutely unavoidable, but won't happen for quite a while. And then as we move down the list, we'll get into some of the more speculative causes that could actually work for a more rapid demise of the human species. Now, you'll say, what has this got to do with creation? The gentlemen and ladies who are heading up the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, Carl Sagan's a little baby, that, you know, there's no hope for humanity unless we tap into an Encyclopedia Galactica, and if we can make contact with some intelligent civilization way out in outer space who's got all of our human problems figured out, then we'll be home free. Never mind the fact that there is an Encyclopedia Galactica available already, but typically people in the SETI program are not prepared to read our Encyclopedia Galactica. So, but one of the things that's the foundation for the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life is the assumption that once some kind of species on a planet achieves a level of technology, that species will gain the capacity to survive for billions of years. And if that has happened billions of years ago, then we could expect that thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even millions of planets would be colonized by this super race that somehow evolved in the past. A number of astronomers like myself have said, now wait a minute, we think it's impossible even for life to originate without a divine being. It's impossible for that simplest life form to change into anything more complicated without a divine being, but it's also impossible for any intelligent species to survive anywhere in the cosmos for the kinds of periods of time that you're thinking about. And so this is a way to kind of slam the door on that. Another application would be, well, Christian theology states that God creates human beings at the end of the window of time for life, so that we get to come upon the scene with the maximum wealth thanks to 4 billion years of previous species of life existing on this planet. We get to come upon the scene with a quadrillion cubic feet of natural gas in the crust of the earth, a trillion barrels of oil, a half trillion tons of coal, 6 feet of topsoil, never mind all the limestone, gypsum, marble, etc., that fuels our civilization. And we have all that because God created us last. But we also see in the pages of the Bible that God's intent is that with human beings on planet Earth, we would witness a relatively rapid conquest of evil, and then we would move into a brand new creation with different laws of physics and different dimensions. Evidently, according to the Bible, God created the universe for the purpose of conquering evil, and God intends to do it quickly, not slowly. And one of the evidences for that would be the fact, well, we don't have that great of a longevity anyway. Anyway, that's kind of a bit of a preamble. One of the things we definitely can't get around is something called the carbonate-silicate cycle. I mentioned that briefly in my message last Sunday, how we are in a situation where all the stable stars in the universe very gradually get brighter and brighter and brighter. Now, our sun happens to rank as the most stable burning star that we can see anywhere in our galaxy and probably the universe. It's incredibly stable. But even as such, it is today 35% brighter than it was when God first created life on planet Earth. And life could only tolerate about a 1% change. And how this has been compensated for is that as the sun's been getting brighter and brighter, we see carbon dioxide and water being removed from the atmosphere of planet Earth and being transformed by plants and animals into sugars, starches, and oils. And then the plate tectonics that's driven by the uranium and thorium decay in the Earth's crust burying that material underground. And so over time, we see a transfer of carbon dioxide and water from the atmosphere to the crust. And this is one reason why we're so rich in resources, is because of that transfer. But the other benefit is this gradually brings down the efficiency of the greenhouse effect. And so over the past 4 billion years, the greenhouse effect of planet Earth is becoming less and less efficient, which means our Earth's atmosphere traps less and less heat. Meanwhile, the sun is getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And this is what's referred to by my peers who are not believers as the amazing double coincidence. We have this increase in the solar luminosity being perfectly compensated for over the past 4 billion years by a decrease in the efficiency of the greenhouse effect, so that the temperature of the surface of planet Earth remains at the just right value for life. And this also explains why when we look at the fossil record, we see different species of life at different times. In order to make this work, you would need the Creator God to create just the right species at just the right quantity at just the right time in order to make sure that the efficiency of the greenhouse effect continues to drop. Okay. At the end of the 20th century, however, we face a problem. Now, almost all the carbon dioxide has already been transferred from the atmosphere to the crust of the Earth. And so we have lost the capacity to compensate for the increase in the solar luminosity. So the solar luminosity goes up and up and up. We are living in a situation where our atmosphere can no longer compensate by God's careful choice of just the right species at just the right time for that increase. And so within 20 to 30 million years, it will be far too hot on the surface of the Earth for life to exist. And who's going to go first? The advanced species of life will disappear first. We're the ones that would be least tolerant to those changes. Although it's possible we might be able to survive a little bit longer than, say, horses or cows or whales, because we could live in air-conditioned facilities. We could live underground. But eventually it's going to get too hot even for those scenarios to work, and we will become extinct. So, but we got 20, 30 million years left. All right. Another factor that we simply cannot get around is the fact that the Earth's rotation rate is slowing down. When God first created life on this planet, it was spinning at 7 hours per day, which is fine if you're a bacterium living on the surface of the earth. It would utterly kill you instantly if you were as large as, say, a mouse or a rat. And the bigger you are, the more devastating it is. They say, well, what's so bad about that? Hey, the faster the planet rotates, then the more rapid the wind velocities. At 7 hours a day, you're looking at 2,000 miles per hour. And obviously, we human beings aren't going to be able to survive that. However, as the rotation rate slows down to 16 hours a day, 18 hours a day, and 24 hours a day, what you discover is that the difference between the daytime temperatures and the night temperatures becomes greater and greater. And so you measure 2 a.m. in the morning and 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and there's your temperature difference. You know, living here in Southern California, we're all aware that's a fair difference. Typically is like anywhere from 25 to 45 degrees difference. And we can handle that, even without air conditioning and heat. However, as our planet rotates with 25 hours a day, and that's exactly what's happening, every year we see our day becoming longer and longer by a few microseconds per day. It's not that big a deal, but over a few million years, it adds up. And so within a few million years, we'll be looking at a 24-hour rotation period and a 26-hour rotation period. And even if you add just 1 hour to the rotation period, that will make a significant difference in the difference between daytime and nighttime. You say, well, how significant? Several degrees centigrade. You say, what's the big deal about that? Well, let's say we're looking at 6 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit difference on the average. Well, if you're talking about peak extremes, in other words, the worst possible situation we would see in a particular day, you would multiply the average increase in temperature extremes by 4. So say we're talking an 8-degree Fahrenheit change. Now that becomes 32 degrees Fahrenheit change. Okay, I've been places in the world where it is so hot if you don't have an air conditioner and you're not healthy and young, you get a good chance of dying. There are places in the world like that today. And we're talking where the temperature might, say, hit 120 degrees with high humidity. You know, 120 with low humidity, you can handle that if you got enough fluids and if you're reasonably young and healthy. But 120 with high humidity, that's devastating. And, only the healthiest people can really handle that. But with air conditioning, you can compensate for it. But now, instead of 120 degrees, we add 16 degrees to that. That's 136. Okay, you make the rotation period 26 hours. Now we're talking 152 degrees. Now what we realize is even someone who's young and healthy isn't going to be able to survive that situation. And everybody's going to have to live in air-conditioned facilities or live underground. And, of course, once it gets up to 27 hours per day, then even that's not going to work. We're in real trouble. And keep in mind that we human beings can probably handle these temperature extremes better than the plants that we need to maintain our food supply. You start imposing a 10-degree greater temperature extreme on the crops that we're trying to grow, you discover that they begin dying off wholesale. So probably in that scenario, what would kill us off would be the fact that the species of life that we depend upon, you know, cows and pigs and wheat and rice, oats, that all gets wiped out, and then we human beings don't have enough to eat, and we die off. What are we talking about in terms of time? Well, 10 to 20 million years, okay? So it's just a little bit less than the 20 to 30 million years for the carbonate silicate cycle. Okay, what's a faster way we could go? Well, the one you hear in the press is asteroid and comet collisions. Well, asteroid and comet collisions that are big enough to totally exterminate any animal larger than a cat, that only happens about every 50 million years. However, there are smaller events that would have the potential of wiping out species like ourselves. We're a little more sensitive to those kinds of events than, say, a dog or a cat or a rat. And maybe every 10 million years, we'd be seeing an event of sufficient catastrophe that it would wipe us out. And, hey, maybe even every million years, we'd see an event that would wipe out all the cities that are located less than 300 feet above sea level. You know, guess what? That's where most of the people on planet Earth live. I mean, you get an asteroid that's 1,000 feet across smashing into an ocean, you got gigantic tidal waves. And it's going to, if it hits the land, it's going to throw up a lot of dust and begin to wipe out crops that we would need to survive upon. So anywhere from 10 to 50 million years, that could happen. Smaller events are much more likely. Every 10,000 years, you get an asteroid collision with the Earth. That's the equivalent of a Nagasaki or a Hiroshima atomic bomb. So 10,000 years. But that's not going to wipe out the human race. You literally have to wait every 10 million years. But you know what? This is all random. This doesn't happen regularly. It's totally random, which means it could happen a year from now, as likely as it could happen 10 million years from now. But it's not something I personally would take out insurance against. Okay? Number four on the list, which I think would happen a lot more quickly than these three that I've mentioned, would be a supernova eruption. This would be a star, a giant star that runs out of fuel and would explode, and would explode with the energy equivalent of 100 or 200 billion other stars. Now, typically, when we astronomers see a supernova eruption in a galaxy, that one star for a period of 5 months will outshine the entire galaxy of 1 or 200 billion stars. It's a dramatic event. But the real drama in terms of life is it showers out a huge amount of gamma rays. And it's these gamma rays that would exterminate the advanced life on our planet. Certain insects would do pretty well in a supernova eruption, although if it's exceptionally close, very little survives at all. I mean, the bacteria get wiped out. Viruses would probably survive, but the bacteria are gone. They're going to have a hard time making a living, too. But more typically, we're looking at something like, say, the star Betelgeuse going supernova. That's 300 light years away. It's not close enough to wipe out the cockroaches. They would survive quite fine, but we human beings would certainly be at risk. Exactly, I can't say for sure because every supernova is different if it's not a type 1A supernova. And so we know, for example, that the star Betelgeuse is on the verge of going supernova. When I say verge, I mean any time in the next 10,000 years. Will it wipe out the human species? There's a good chance it will, but there's also a chance it won't. But if it doesn't, it's certainly going to make life really miserable for us because it's going to do a lot of damage to our food crops and our animals. You get a huge amount of ultraviolet radiation coming in. We would certainly see a tremendous increase in cancer deaths. And so, yeah, we'd be looking at hundreds of millions of people dying, but maybe not the entire human race going extinct. On the other hand, if it's a decent enough explosion, we could see extinction. Now then, how often does this happen? Hey, every 100 years per galaxy. And ours is a big galaxy. If a supernova doesn't explode in our neighborhood, it's not going to bring about our extinction. On the other hand, it's simply a matter of time before you get a supernova in your neighborhood that would wipe out all the advanced species of life on planet Earth. One thing I can tell you is a guarantee. You know that star we call Sirius? It's only 8 light years away. If Sirius goes supernova, we're all in serious trouble. And we know that it's only got a couple of million years of fuel left. And so, you know, a couple of million years from now, that thing would go supernova and we'd be history. So that's one way to put a cap on this. In fact, I shared that with a group of theologians at Reformed Theological Seminary. That's a campus where we have a number of Christian scholars who believe that Jesus Christ will not return for his people for at least 3 million more years. Now he's making a suggestion. I think he's probably going to need to come back a little more rapidly than that because there are physical factors that will bring about our extermination in less time than those 3 million years. Okay, let me get to stuff that's a little more speculative. One that was a favorite topic of discussion in the 1950s was an all-out nuclear exchange that would exterminate the human species. And that's not the only war scenario that we can envision which would bring about the total extermination of the species. Which brings up something else. You know, biological warfare. You could also have a biological accident. Bacteria and viruses especially mutate very efficiently. And when they mutate, we could find ourselves in a situation where our biological defenses get overwhelmed. And it's also interesting that we live in a society where we human beings are setting up an environment to encourage the mutations of viruses and bacteria. What I mean by that is that society is engaging in practices where there's the exchange of warm body fluids taking place between people at a rate that's unprecedented in human history. And, there's a reason why we see new viruses coming out of the homosexual community, for example, or in those societies where they practice a lot of anal intercourse. And we can expect that if these kinds of practices, drug abuse, where people are sharing needles, these things are not brought under control, we could find ourselves faced with a new strain that could be deadly to the species. How realistic do we think that is? Well, the Center for Disease Control says in order for it to really bring about the extermination of the human population, there would have to be something that is incredibly deadly, that remains in a long incubation period. I mean, you've seen all these movies that have been talking about these epidemic disasters. The flaw in the plot is that we're looking at diseases that have incubation periods of a few hours or a few days. That will not bring about the extermination of the human population if we're on the ball. Because what you do is you simply isolate the people that have got the problem, and we're only talking a few days incubation period. You can take drastic measures to cut off those people from the rest of the human species and eventually bring the disease under control. The problem is if it's got an incubation period of 1 or 2 or 3 years, then that means that the carriers of the disease are traveling on all of our aircraft all over the world, spreading their affliction to people all over in a way that we really aren't going to be able to control it. And what the Center for Disease Control is pointing out, because of the amount of travel that's going on today, people traveling all over the world, not just a few of us, but millions of us doing this, and doing this on a regular basis, if that kind of a germ ever developed, the human species could be at a severe risk. Ebola, yeah, it was incredibly deadly, but it has a very short incubation period and therefore wasn't a threat to the human species. But take something like Ebola that's got an incubation period of several years and we'd be in trouble. HIV is like that. It's got a long incubation period. But fortunately, it can only be spread through warm body or warm fluid transmission. And that does help. Okay. And this one is brand new. By the way, when we talk about all of nuclear war, I want to remind you a scenario we see in the pages of the Bible. We're studying the flood account in our class. Is not war, but civil violence. Where people are at peace in terms of their national structure, but within the national societies, you have crime unchecked. And what was happening the days before the flood is that the crime of murder was not being effectively brought under control, and the human species was in danger of self-extermination. And the Bible warns us that the environment for civil violence at that level is generated by nationalities or nations disappearing and being replaced with a unified government. And so if we move towards a one-world government, then we're fostering an environment which could generate that kind of civil evil. Kind of like what you see in modern times in 1960s in China, Soviet Russia, Nazi Germany. And what's happening is a nation gaining total control over its citizens, so the citizens can't leave. And in that case, what you have is the equivalent of a monopoly over those citizens. And it's just like with corporations. Give them a monopoly and they will be tempted to oppress their citizens. And the more effective the monopoly, the more likely we are to see extreme oppression of the citizenry. And so that's another way it could happen and was happening in the days before the flood. The final one I got on my list just got published a few days ago. And it's called Information Overload. It was written by a couple of cyber professors. And they made the point that the level of stress amongst citizens today that are on the information superhighway is going up at an extremely rapid rate. And the point is that all of us are under the stress of having to process way too much information. I don't know what it's like with you, but a lot of people get 50 to 100 emails a day. And they feel compelled to respond to all those emails. And it puts them under a lot of stress. Never mind that, your boss expects you to be surfing the net and picking up all this information so that you can be processing your reports. We're under the strain of having to read far more than we ever had before. And I like the final sentence in this article. It makes the comment, "We may find ourselves within just a few years being overwhelmed by our creations, when the intelligence required to achieve a certain level of technology may be a whole lot less than what is needed to survive it." And this ties in with something that I shared a few weeks ago when we had one of these events, and that is the fact that the human species today is accumulating negative or deleterious mutations at a very rapid rate. All of us experience mutations in our DNA. What they've been discovering is that we've been accumulating negative mutations, mutations that are harmful for our survival at a much higher rate than what geneticists has ever presumed. And keep in mind, it's only in the last 6 months that geneticists have had the capacity to actually measure the rate at which any species would be accumulating a negative or deleterious mutation. And they've done it on four species: gorillas, chimpanzees, orangutans, and human beings. And the answer they get for human beings is that each individual accumulates three negative mutations per generation. So per generation, per person, it's three. But the article made the point that because of the way our society is structured, that rate will go up. And what causes it to go up is an increase in the standard of living. I mean, it's not just the United States that has a higher standard of living. Every nation in the world has a higher standard of living. And that higher standard of living has resulted in people with a lot of negative mutations surviving long enough to reproduce and have children. And so, unlike 100 years ago, we human beings are passing a lot more negative mutations on to our children than was possible before, simply because we have the capacity to survive to make that possible. The other factor that is significant is that men are having children at a much later time in their life than was true 100 years ago. And again, I would refer to this information overload. Because we live in a high-tech society, we men typically have to put off the time that we get married. I didn't get married till I was 32. And one of the problems was I had to get my PhD behind me and my postdoctoral fellowship behind me. Hey, by the time that happened, I was 30 years old. And it's not just true of me, it's true of men all over the world. We're being forced by the high-tech, information-saturated society in which we live to put off the date in which we get married and begin to have children. And now the problem with that is, as a man gets older and older, more and more negative mutations wind up in his sperm. And so more of that gets passed on to the next generation. The end result of which is that, according to these geneticists, we could be looking at maybe the most rapid scenario for the extinction of the human species, simply that our genetic capacity to survive is dropping so rapidly. And the people who published this information overload article said this stress is bound to have an impact on generating more negative mutations. So that's kind of the worst case scenario, that it would be our success in putting together such a marvelous civilization and high-tech society with this tremendously bountiful standard of living that could bring about our quickest demise. Okay, that thought would be a nice cheery note in which to end, and I saw a hand over here. You know, usually I stop talking when I see two hands. I've only seen one so far, but maybe I just should have shared with you the rule. And by the way, we have a microphone here and a microphone over here. We're going to encourage you to come up to the microphone. If you're super shy, we might make an exception, but if at all possible, come up to the microphone. That way we can all hear the question. And the rule is this. You can ask as many questions as you like, but only one question per turn at the mic. So you can ask one question, you can go to the back of the line, then you can come up and ask the next question. And that will help my failing memory. Okay. Who'd like to be first? As I said, I saw a hand somewhere over here, my peripheral vision, yes? Okay, the question from Jeannie is, you know, we're surveying all these science journals for these new discoveries that point to new evidences for the God of the Bible. How about the authors of these articles? Are they seeing the same connections that we're seeing as we look at their papers? In some cases, yes, in some cases, no. Probably where I see it happening the most would be in a science like astronomy or cosmology. For example, this paper that I was referring to, the Supernova Cosmology Project, they do note that we're looking at design, although they don't use the word design. But they are cognizant of the fact that there is this element of fine-tuning, therefore design, therefore a designer. But they don't make all those links in the paper that we do, but they certainly point out the fact that there's this incredible fine-tuning going on. But if you look in the biological sciences, you're looking at something that's far more complicated than astronomy, and typically researchers there have a hard time seeing the forest because of the trees. They're so focused on the little narrow subject area that they're studying that they miss the big picture. And this is one reason we felt it was very important to get a research biologist on our staff who could really begin giving that much more serious attention than I was able to do. And so that's what Dr. Fazran is doing right now. And he makes the comment all the time, says, you know, astronomers usually see the meaning of what they're researching. But in biology, it's practically non-existent. Unless, of course, you're dealing with biologists that are making mathematical models, then they're much more likely to see the big picture philosophical, theological connections. Incidentally, a lot of scientific researchers are supportive of reasons to believe because they say, you know, we have to specialize to produce, and we need you at Reasons to Believe to help us see the big picture of what we're doing. And so a lot of these researchers will send papers to us saying, we don't know if this is important, but check it out and see if it is. And if it is, let us know. So a lot of that goes on. Yes.
Along the same tenor, things in biology are changing. I know in the class that I'm working with right now, when I went through school and took biology classes, there were two kingdoms. Now we're teaching a six-kingdom system. In biology, they're recognizing that there are things that are changing, and evolution, as it had been taught years ago, is no longer as classical. What kinds of changes are happening in that in biology, and do you have people or staff at Reasons to address that?
Okay. Do we have staff at Reasons to address that? Yes, we do. We have what we call our biology think tank. which would be mainly biology professors from places like UC Irvine, Caltech, UCLA, USC, that get together every 3 months and discuss these various kinds of issues. And I think what Steve was bringing out is, you know, biology is so complicated, it's hard even to define our terms well. It's not like particle physics, where we can tell you very concretely the difference between a proton and a neutron. Biologists have great difficulty describing the differences between one species and another species as part of the same genus, or why we would put species in this genus and not that genus. Again, it's simply that these were studying things that are so complex that it's very difficult to tell where the boundaries are, where the definitions are. And so this has a problem when you talk about, say, creation evolution. A lot of the debate centers over speciation. You know, how do creatures speciate? As natural speciation appropriate to explain everything? Where do we need to introduce supernatural speciation? Hey, maybe an even bigger problem is simply agreeing what a species is. Because often I see creationists and evolutionists debating, well, speciation happened here? No, it didn't. But they both have different definitions of what the species is. And so that's one of the factors that makes it difficult to resolve creation-evolution issues in the biological sciences. Again, what we've been trying to stress through Reasons to Believe, interpret the complex sciences in the context of the simple sciences. From the simple sciences, I can tell an origin of life researcher, whatever theory you develop or hypothesis, it's got to be able to produce results in less than 10 to the 17 seconds, because that's all the time the universe will give you. And so if they come up with some origin of life scenario that requires 10 to the 100 years, we can say we know that one's wrong. The simple sciences simply don't give you that amount of time. Or if you need more than 10 to the 79 protons and neutrons, then we know you're barking up the wrong tree. There aren't that many neutrons and protons in the entire universe, let alone the surface of the Earth. So that's an example of how you could proceed there. Let me give you the good news. I think fairly rigorous definitions are just around the corner. And the problem is that biologists have been trying to build their definition based on morphology, the structure of the body parts and the organs. And that's really complicated. We don't even know precisely what that structure is most of the time. There's a movement within biology to replace that with chemistry, to try to classify different species of life by the chemistry of their DNA, RNA, and proteins. And that has the potential to be a lot more rigorous, but it's also a lot hard, it's a lot of hard work. That means you've got to have maps of the chemical structure of all the proteins, DNA, and RNA of thousands of different species of life. And we've only mapped the genome of a little more than a half dozen species, and hey, they're all bacteria and worms and things. It's nothing complicated that's been mapped yet. Go ahead.
You were talking about the potential for future of the human race, but I didn't hear you mention the one we were learning about recently, that I thought there was like a 7,000-year window approximately for humans to survive on Earth, having to do with, I forget if it was precession of equinoxes and the polar stability of the Earth or the axis.
I didn't mention, Greg, the orbital limitations on advanced life on planet Earth. And the thousands of years that we were speaking about is the period at which we see variations going on in the tilt of the axis of the Earth, which I think is 41,000 years. And then there's one for the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit about the sun. That's how elliptical the orbit is. It varies a little bit. I believe that period was 100,000 years. You put those two cycles together and you can derive some very interesting climatic disaster scenarios. But those disaster scenarios produce disasters detrimental to the human species every few million years. Okay, and this is fairly recently discovered. models are still being worked out exactly what kind of disastrous scenario we would get from these periods. And what you really need to do is work out how long it takes for the 41,000-year extreme to line up perfectly with the 100,000-year extreme. And we may be looking at something as brief as maybe 500,000 years, but it could be as long as a few million years. So the math is still being worked out. But that would be another limitation if you're talking about us making it 1,000,000 years or more. Over here? Oh, I'll take the microphone first. Go ahead. You can come up to the mic if you want. Yeah, go. I'm supposed to give priority to the microphone. Yeah.
Hello, hello, hello.
Yes.
Hello. Are we on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. One, I wasn't entirely sure about you. You say we have a reliable measurement for the total amount of mass in the universe.
Yes.
I'm not sure I know how that's done.
Okay, how do we get a measure of the total mass of the universe? There's actually a whole bunch of ways we can do that, but some of them are really messy and complicated. Let me dispense with that and give you the simple ones. Okay? The one that you see in this paper is considered the most accurate, and that was to carefully measure how rapidly the universe is expanding at different points in the history of the universe. And so what they actually point out in this paper is we see the expansion velocity of the universe slowing down for the first 9 billion years, and then it speeds up for the last 6 billion. The speeding up due to the cosmological constant, the slowing down due to the mass. You can measure the rate at which the universe slows down in its expansion for the first 9 billion years, and that will tell you the total mass that exists in the universe. And they figure out it's 28% of the mass that would be necessary to actually bring the universe into a state of no expansion. Another way you can do it is through gravitational lensing. And what you do there is you look at, you know, some distant quasar, and you notice there's a mass between you and the quasar that is bending the light of the quasar, forming this nice little circle you see on your map of that quasar. And if you measure the dimensions of that circle, that will tell you how much mass is involved in the lens that's between you and the quasar. And the mass that you would get would be to measure the total mass, the visible mass plus the stuff you can't see. Because the invisible matter will also gravitationally bend light just like the visible matter would. You know, a third way would be to look at the cosmic background radiation. The fluctuations in that cosmic background radiation are sensitive to the total mass of the universe. And so we've got, I'd say in the last year, there have been 15 papers published giving us a measure of the mass of the universe, but they're measuring the total mass. And we got other ways to measure the visible mass. What we didn't have were direct ways to measure the invisible mass. The technique that John Cormody used was to look at the orbital dynamics of these dwarf galaxies as they, you know, revolve around the big galaxies. He was able to figure out there's a whole lot of mass involved in that little galaxy that we can't see. And if you do that on a few thousand dwarf galaxies, you get a fairly accurate measure. Okay, over here.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, just what is it that the diehard proponents for evolutionary theory and naturalistic origins of life viewpoints, what are they pointing to? It seems like there's so much skepticism going on even amongst themselves. What is it that they have? I mean, what can they put on the table and say, this is our evidence?
Okay, what the evolutionists have as hard evidence is the fossil record. You look at the fossil record and you can see that over a few billion years you have this progression from simple life to complex life. And they're assuming that this progression is driven by natural causes. They have proposed two natural causes: natural selection within a species and mutations. Now, that really only does things efficiently if the species is sexual. If it's asexual, it's a whole different ball of wax. And the problem there is life started off as being asexual. And that's been one of the challenges of Darwinian evolution. How do you explain the natural evolution of sex from no sex? But that's hardly ever discussed in the literature, but it is a problem. So the data is the situation, and you know, our criticism from Reasons to Believe is we see nothing wrong with the data. We believe the time scale is accurate. We believe that the morphological structures seen in these fossils are accurate. Where we're critical is the assumption that you get from species A to species B to species C through natural process only. If you're appealing to natural selection mutations, it really only works if the species has more than a quadrillion individuals and a generation time less than 3 months. And so, for example, we can see through real-time observations a virus mutate into a very different strain. I mean, that was kind of the threat of an epidemic. If you're talking bacteria and viruses, you're talking about species that are rather efficiently driven by Darwinian mechanisms. But that won't work for horses, pigs, cows, and human beings. We're far below that one quadrillion number of individuals in our species, and our generation time is 20 years, not 3 months. And so what happens to us? We go extinct. Okay, when biologists observe birds and mammals in the real world, have they ever seen speciation? The answer is no. It's zero. Have we seen extinction? Yeah, a whole lot of it. And the smaller the population, the higher the probability of extinction. Okay, how have devout evolutionary biologists espousing naturalism responded to this? Well, the best educated and most knowledgeable of the evolutionary biologists now freely admit natural selection and mutations cannot be it. It's woefully inadequate to explain what we see in the fossil record. And some of them have been willing to say the only possible explanation is God. But there are others who have said, well, God is unacceptable for moral reasons or whatever, and therefore they're looking elsewhere. They're saying somewhere out there in the vast realm of nature, there must be a hidden mechanism we don't understand. But they're appealing to something that we can't see or measure. The closest they've come up with is something called chaos theory, which is to say if you've got a complex enough system, and the system is big enough, filling enough environmental niches, then there is a possibility that you'll get a significant departure from thermodynamic equilibrium in one of them. And what it's really doing is saying that we're going to have entropy increase, which means things get more disorganized. But if you disorganize things greatly enough in 99% of the universe, then you can get by the principles of thermodynamics a little extra organization in that 1%. The problem is the laws of thermodynamics tell us you don't get very much of a departure. And the bigger the departure, the more rapidly that tiny system must revert back to thermodynamic equilibrium. And the challenge there is pick up any organism, and the snapback time to thermodynamic equilibrium is less than a trillionth of a second. And life has been here on the planet for a lot longer than a trillionth of a second, therefore it can't be chaos theory. Nice try, man. What I really see going on is they're trying to appeal more and more to that which we can't see, measure, understand, or is too complicated for us to really figure out.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah. I think you might have answered this, and you alluded to it earlier. Is it possible that God's still in an act of creating?
Is it possible that God is still active in creating? This is addressed in both the Old and New Testaments of the Bible, and the answer is yes and no. Okay, God is active in certain arenas, and he's not active in others. And this is really what undergirds a lot of the Bible's teaching about the Sabbath. The Sabbath is that period within our work week in which we cease from doing certain functions, but we don't cease from all functions. And our pattern is God. God ceased from certain functions when he celebrated his day of rest. But during that day of rest, he is exercising the freedom to perform other activities. So he would say to us in the New Testament, for example, hey, you celebrate the Sabbath, you stop your employment, but you still feed your children. And likewise, I am free to raise somebody from the dead or to heal them from a disease or some kind of infirmity. What God has stopped doing on a Sabbath is creating new species of life. So when he created Eve, he stopped creating new species of life. And so the fossil record testifies to those six periods of time when God was active in creating new species of life. But during the seventh creation day, he has ceased from doing that. And according to both the Old and New Testament, we are still within that seventh creation day. And so this is that period of time when God does not create new species of life. And so in terms of what's going on in biology, we see speciation before human beings. We don't see it after human beings. Yes.
Yes, I understand that you met with the very renowned skeptic Michael Shermer on Friday.
Yes.
And I just wanted to find out what that was about and how did it go?
Well, I thought it went well. Dr. Fuzz Rana and myself spent 3 hours with Michael Shermer just this past Friday. And we basically agreed to meet just to hear one another out. And he wanted to know why we don't do debates in certain contexts, and so we had a chance to explain, well, we're happy to do debates if they have educational value, which means that we keep the subject narrow and we have a debate in front of scholars who are aware of the subject material. We're not all that interested in having a debate in front of a lay audience where the subject is very broad, because that tends to play into non-educational directions. And who can shout the loudest and bring out the most emotion and get enough of his supporters at the debate that will tend to come across. And I was very grateful for the meeting from one thing. One of his colleagues in the skeptic club at Caltech went on the radio with me, and this was many years ago, and was incredibly rude and pugnacious. And he identified himself as Michael Shermer, and falsely. And I had a chance to find out from Michael Shermer that he wasn't that guy that went on KFI radio with me and behaved so rudely. So personally, my opinion of Michael Shermer has shot up about that much. Having that point clarified, and he said, yes, this guy in the skeptic says, we're trying to get him out of the club because he lies about his degrees and he lies about his name. And he's incredibly rude. So it was good to get that on. I mean, I never knew those kinds of things would go on, that people wouldn't even use their right name. Blame it on some other guy who's really quite mellow. And but no, if you don't know Michael, he was quite active in the Christian community back in the early 70s. And really got soured by this end times prophecy movement of the Jesus movement. You know, primarily stuff coming out from Hal Lindsey, and he assumed that it was a very high scholarly level. And by the way, I think Hal is doing some decent work, but he himself admits it's not the kind of sound scholarship that you'd be getting from seminary professors who work in that arena. And so my take is that Michael kind of got soured by some of those experiences. And wound up saying, well, science is more reliable than this stuff. But he was very intrigued by where we're coming from. And the fact, he assumed we were young earth creationists. Once he found out we were not young earth creationists, his whole demeanor changed. So I think there's some room for some real positive interchange there. And by the way, our Reasons to Believe chapters in other cities are quite active in these skeptics clubs. They join these skeptics clubs by making the point that, hey, the skepticism is all directed towards belief. You need some skepticism directed towards unbelief. We need to balance this. And we've noticed with skeptics clubs in other cities that there's been some real positive exchange going on between our people and their people in trying to balance out the skepticism so it's not so one-sided. And just to communicate the message that the Christian faith is a faith that encourages skepticism. A lot of these skeptics have the idea that anybody who's involved in religion or theology is following blind faith. And so we just had a chance to share with Michael personally that the Bible never supports that kind of faith seeking. Apostle Paul, everything must be tested. Hold fast to that which proves to be good and true. Three Hebrew words, the one Greek word for faith, all have as their base definition, acting upon established truth. There is no room within Christianity for blind faith. It's a faith that's to be tested, and one of our criticisms of the skeptics clubs at Caltech and elsewhere, they're not doing enough skepticism, they're not doing enough testing. Yes.
This is a question about the anthropic principle. Now, there's this amazing list that you've got of all the things that have to be true within such very narrow bounds in order for us to exist. Even the latest connections has a list of the various elements that we need some of in our body, but if we don't get any, we'll die, and if we get too much, it can also hurt us or we can die. And the thought that occurs to me when I read these lists is, okay, if we include these in our lists, then isn't it incumbent on us to say that we couldn't have started out with these elements already in certain abundances and been developed to adapt to these abundances rather than the abundances having been supplied in just the amounts that were needed in order for us to become human beings?
Yeah, I agree with that premise, that indeed we look at these very finely tuned abundances of elements, and particularly when you recognize that that mix of abundant elements is unique to the Earth. You know, as we look at other solar system bodies, as we look at other stars, we don't see the just right mix of vanadium and molybdenum, iron, chromine, things that we would call vital poisons. Arsenic, by the way, is in that list. You need arsenic to live, but if you get too much, you die. And I think we have counted 18 elements in the atomic chart where you have to have enough to live, but if you get too much, you die. And it's like arsenic, the difference is rather narrow. And Earth is one of those rare, exceptional places where you got just the right mix, and doesn't that force you to the conclusion that that was created before we human beings were created, knowing that this is the one place where we would get that just right mix. And I've described in this book the incredible events that are necessary in the history of both our galaxy and our solar system to get that just right abundance of all these elements that are necessary for life. And you can add to that things like uranium and thorium. These are the mechanisms that drive earthquakes and volcanism, which is essential for life. And our Earth has the distinction of having an incredible high abundance of uranium and thorium. Okay.
I know a question that I've struggled with in the course of my faith is I certainly accept and am awestruck by the evidence that our Creator had to fine-tune the conditions in the cosmos to initiate life. And I wonder why this Creator would choose to create dangerous or harmful life forms such as bacteria or viruses, disease vectors, or do we assume a design flaw intrinsic in creation that would allow for mutations resulting in harmful life forms, like a built-in biological time bomb, so to
speak? Okay, good question. And that's really the number one reason that Stephen Gould gives for the fact that he's not a believer. He says, look at all the parasites that exist. And a good God wouldn't make parasites. Well, the first thing you can say about that is, before you claim that a good God wouldn't make parasites, do you really understand what parasites are all about? And then maybe these parasites aren't as evil as you think they are. And it's incumbent upon the Stephen Goulds to really prove their point that these parasites are not good. And hey, we don't even know the life cycle of a parasite very well, or how it fits into the larger ecosystem, then I'd say it's a little bit making your mouth full to say this is evil and therefore God can't exist because he wouldn't do this. Just because it's harmful to us. Well, the other factor here is, to what degree have we human beings been responsible for putting these parasites in places where God never intended them? Okay, there's that factor too. And so this is another example where you're trying to discount God's existence based on a poor understanding of something that's incredibly complicated. And that's not a fair thing to do if you see that there's very sound evidence for that good God coming out of the simple sciences. You know, that should drive you to say, well, maybe I'd better study this a little better and really understand what's going on. Gould, for example, is one who said, you know, there can't be a God because look at how clumsy the panda's thumb is. And if God created the panda, he wouldn't have made such a horrible design in that thumb. Well, there have been a number of biologists who have produced rebuttals, both research papers and books, to the effect that the panda's thumb is an amazing engineering tool, given that that panda was going to survive on bamboo leaves. You know, it's the perfect tool for stripping bamboo leaves off a tree. In fact, we're going to have an article in our Facts for Faith that talks about the design of the panda's thumb. So that's a good example of someone rather too quickly attributing bad design when in fact there really is good design. It's bad design for X, but what if that creature has been designed for Y? Then you get a whole different situation. One of the things we can say, for example, is that before God created Adam and Eve, mosquitoes were in local regions of the planet. Regions of the planet where they were vital for the ecosystem. For example, in the Canadian North, these giant mosquitoes they have, it's the only thing in that environment that will eat the feces of lemmings. And so you need these mosquitoes there to take care of that waste product and recycle it. But what we have done as human beings is to carry those mosquitoes from where God intended that they would habitate and survive, and spread them to places where God never intended them. So today, mosquitoes are virtually worldwide, whereas in the past, they were just in local areas. Another example of that is the housefly. The housefly was not ubiquitous before we human beings came upon the scene. It is now. Rat, same situation. So things that we call vermin and parasites, let's see what we human beings have done to disturb the balance that God set up, and also to recognize a lot of creatures that we call parasites actually help the hosts. You know, a good parasite is a parasite that doesn't kill its host. Okay, if it kills its host, that's an unsuccessful parasite. It will go extinct. And that's what happens. If a parasite mutates and becomes too successful, then it's going to disappear. That's one of the checks on parasitism. It only works if it doesn't do too much damage to its host. It works even better if it makes an exchange with the host. It says, well, you give me X, and I'll give you Y. And then what you have there is symbiosis. So, for example, you've got fungus and bacteria and blue-green algae that work together. And each species will steal something from the other species, but they give something back. And the end result is all three species survive in a much higher quality state than if the so-called parasites didn't exist. And, you know, there's still a lot we don't understand here, but let's acknowledge that. Yes.
Could you give us an update on your mock trial in Virginia?
Could I give an update on our mock trial in Virginia? Well, what was happening was the Virginia Trial Lawyers Association, in response to the Kansas School Board decision on teaching science in the public school classroom, decided they wanted to do a mock trial, which would be a, kind of an enactment of the equivalent of a Supreme Court case dealing with this situation in Kansas or something like it. And they had invited James Miller, who's a leading evolutionist, to be a witness for the side that says, no, we really only need to teach naturalism in the public education system. And I was going to be the witness for the other side that says, no, we need to teach science in an environment where we're open to all forms of interpretation and challenge each position to put out a testable model and use these testable models as a way to decide what's right and what's wrong, or what is still worthy of investigation. It didn't happen. It didn't happen because it was scheduled right in the window of that. What was that hurricane that went through North Carolina and Virginia? Floyd, yeah. So I was in North Carolina when Floyd was hitting, but fortunately, students don't seem to care. They'd canceled all the classes at Duke University the day I was scheduled to speak. we decided not to cancel our event, and the auditorium was full. They came anyway, and it was falling. You know, rain was pouring down about 2 inches an hour, but they all came anyway. But the Virginia trial lawyers weren't undergraduate students, so they canceled their event, and it's a good thing they did, because they were holding it in a hall that was right on the banks of the James River, and that James River overflowed and would have made it impossible. Bottom line, they're going to reschedule for January. And Regent University is going to come in as a co-sponsor. It's going to become a much bigger event than what they had planned. It will be video recorded, and they've agreed to give us the rights to the video when it's available. Yes.
Hi, just another question. This was relating to skeptics often pointing to the problem of evil as supposedly evidence that there's no God. But I was wondering if how much further have you gotten on addressing the problem of evil a little bit more directly, and also taking into account the ultimacy of God, because obviously He's there first, you know, no matter what, we can't get around that. So,
well, the little luncheon we had with Michael Shermer, the issue of evil came up, and he immediately agreed with us that if believers are to solve that problem, it's got to be solved outside of the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. He also agreed with us that that's exactly what the Christian perspective on evil is. That, you know, there's a bigger picture. God works beyond space and time. He's a God that's powerful enough to create 10 space-time dimensions and creating a universe. So I found it interesting that he was very sympathetic to the idea that you can solve the problem of evil in that bigger context, letting God be God. And this is something we've laid out in our book, Beyond the Cosmos. I think it's on the table over here. And a whole lot of the latter chapters of that book are focusing on giving an answer, a good answer to the problem of evil. Why would a good God, a powerful God, a loving God, put us in a situation where we're exposed to evil and suffering? And the point is, you get there first by solving the problem of free will, human free choice, and divine predetermination. Once you've got that solution under your belt, and by the way, that solution's only possible if you look at it from a bigger context than the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. And you solve that, then you can solve evil and suffering. Rather than go into all the details I have in the book, let me make this point, that what distinguishes Christianity from all other religions, one of the things that distinguishes it, is the message that God is not going to restore paradise. He's going to deliver us from paradise. The Garden of Eden is not the absence of evil and suffering. What it is the very best possible situation for us human beings, given the laws of physics. And keep in mind, when God had Adam and Eve in Eden, He had evil walled out. Evil was not permitted to come in initially. Then God opened the door and let evil come in. That was God's decision to allow Adam and Eve to be exposed to evil. Why did God do that? Because God's intention was never that Adam and Eve would spend forever in Eden. Rather, that Adam and Eve would be trained to experience and enjoy forever a place that's far superior to anything the laws of physics would permit. And so, that's what's really going on. You can't solve the problem of evil without first studying what the Bible has to say about the new creation. Okay. Hey, I want to give you one little more. I think, have you ever taken college courses?
Not in religion.
No, I mean any college course at all.
Sure.
Have you paid money for those courses?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you've probably paid a lot. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting thing about students is they pay a lot of money to an institution to suffer at the hand of a professor. You know, why do they do that? They do that because their eyes are on a career that's going to last 40 years, and they know this course they're taking is only going to last 4 months. Same perspective here. The exposure to evil and suffering only lasts a few decades. and it prepares us to receive this wonderful new creation for all of eternity. Same principle. The problem is, most of us human beings would rather go back to Eden. And when I hear atheists object to evil as an argument against God, what I'm really hearing from those atheists is a heart desire to go back to Eden. And that's the best way to address those atheists. Forget about their challenge about evil and there being no God. Really get at that heart desire to go back to something better than what we are experiencing right now. And we all know that's possible. You know, a powerful God could put us right back in Eden. Moses could have taken the Israelites back to Egypt. But no, instead he took them through the suffering of the wilderness forward to the land of promise. And God's kind of doing the same thing with us. He's taking us kicking and screaming, in spite of all of our complaints and grumpiness, through the evil and suffering to something far better than what we want. Okay, go ahead. Oh, go ahead.
In a recent news magazine, the cover article was on how man evolved, and in that article there were pictures of many skulls that were supposedly related to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of these skulls we know they've done...
Is Newsweek or Time? Time. Okay. They did a major piece on human origins. We're going to be posting a piece written by Dr. Fazrana. It's about 20 pages long, which is a detailed response to the Time magazine article and to the research papers on which it was based. And what you saw in that Time magazine article were all these skulls. And really, if you look carefully, you'll see they were parts of skulls. Seldom did they have the whole skull. It was portions of skulls. And the classic interpretation is, well, we take these skulls and we only got, say, a little piece of it. What we're going to do is fill that piece up level with beans or seeds. And then we're going to measure the volume of those seeds or beans, and we'll be able to figure out the volume that the brain of that species had. And by that means, they've been able to plot a chart which shows the Australopithecines existing 4 million years ago, human beings today, Homo habilis and Homo erectus, Neanderthal, other species in between, and they show a nice straight line fit. Now, what's happened in the literature, it's been published in Nature as well as Science, in the last year, articles to the effect that trying to measure the volume of a skull, the brain capacity of a skull, through sand or beans or seeds is not a good way to do it, especially if all you got is one-fifth of the skull. And so what they're now doing is CAT scans. They're using X-ray tomography to map the particular portion, and then they use different mathematical models of skulls to try to calculate the total volume. And it's still not a very accurate method, but it's a whole lot more accurate than just filling the thing up with sand or beans, at least 10 times more accurate. And what they're discovering there is they're not getting a straight line fit. What they're getting is a fit that looks like this. Then it goes up. And so you don't see this progression step by step of the brain getting bigger and bigger with respect to time. And so that's one of the pieces that Fuzz is bringing into the article. That, you know, the Time magazine spin really isn't the spin that the researchers are putting on it in the literature. And what you're seeing in the literature is a challenge to the Darwinian paradigm rather than support for it. And I think you're referring to also to the fact that, at least with Neanderthal, we got chemical evidence that they had no relationship with us. Geneticists have been able to recover mitochondrial DNA from a Neanderthal fossil. Interestingly, the very same fossil that launched Charles Darwin to fame. The first Neanderthal fossil ever discovered, 1856, is also the very fossil that they found as Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA, which shows that that DNA is so radically different from human DNA, there is no possibility that Neanderthals had any biological link or chemical link to human beings. So Neanderthals are not part of our line of descent. And if Neanderthal is kicked out of the line of descent, then you've got to go back about 600,000 years to find any other fossil that could be, quote, our ancestor. And those fossils are so extremely different from human fossils that you're not going to get that happening through Darwinian mechanisms in just 600,000 years. In fact, these clocks now establish that we have five species that can't be biologically linked to any other species: Neanderthals, human beings, orangutans, chimpanzees, and gorillas. And those are the only species they've measured them on. So that's five for five. Five species they've measured, five species that show no link with the past. Wouldn't it be, or each other? That's the other thing that's interesting. You look at, say, orangutans, chimpanzees, and gorillas. The Y chromosome differentiation inside each species is very small, just like it is with human beings. But the difference in the Y chromosome of an orangutan compared to a chimpanzee is enormous. And that's a severe challenge to a Darwinian paradigm, because Darwinists say these three species have a common ancestor. If they have a common ancestor, we would either expect less differentiation in the Y chromosome species to species, or we would expect more differentiation inside each species. We're not seeing that. And so this is strong evidence that we're looking at special creation rather than any kind of natural evolution. And hey, we've only looked at five species and we found it for all five. Right. Yeah, the common ancestor they think they descended from, then we have no fossil evidence. They're presuming that there's one there. We just haven't discovered it yet. Still looking for it, right? So, but the fun thing would be if we could get 1,000 species measured. Then I think we'd really see a profound change in the way that society looks at Darwinian evolution. Okay, yeah.
I don't know if there's any truth to this, but I've heard people rebut saying, well, what about the similarity between chimpanzees or apes, and they have things only 2% difference in the DNA? And that would just be a
disproportion. Okay, what about the similarities between, say, chimpanzees, gorillas, and human beings? This article just came out yesterday, as a matter of fact. I just picked this up at our office, and it's titled Vive la Difference, Probing Primate Genes. It makes the point that if you look at orangutans, chimpanzees, and human beings, the DNA is 98% identical amongst the four species. But it also makes the point that 2% difference is enormous. And by the way, we also share about 98% similarity with yeast. And I don't see anybody claiming that we're closely related to. Well, I mean, what's really going on here is that if you're a creator making life based on DNA, RNA, and proteins, you're going to be using the same design for lots of different species. But it's the differences that you really can't explain by Darwinian mechanism. You say, well, we're only 2% different. That's like saying, well, we're, what, 98% water? A watermelon's 98% water? And therefore, we're the same, or have the same origin. There's a big difference in how that water is distributed, and the challenge is, okay, let's look at the 2% difference. Is it possible to explain that 2% difference by natural mechanisms within the time frame that the fossil record allows? And these molecular clocks are telling us you don't even come close. And go ahead.
Yeah, on the Adam and Eve thing that you're talking about there, if Adam and Eve were created with free will, and part of what God created us for was to love Him, if they didn't have that tree, if sin wasn't in there, would they ever really have had free will? Because part of free will is the choice to do wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think as a parent, I face the same challenge. How much free will am I prepared to allow my children to exercise? Okay. Some, because I love them. If I put a fence around them in all contexts, then that wouldn't really be an expression of love on my part, so I have to take some risks. But the question is, how much risk? God's got the same problem. How much risk is He willing to take with the human species? And it looks like He's taking quite a bit. And it's because he can see the end result, which is kind of what I do as a parent. You know, I am prepared to expose my sons to a fair amount of risk of suffering and evil because I have some confidence that, hey, even if they choose to go down that path, they will straighten out in the end. And then maybe I give them more liberty than I should. I don't know. I might be overestimating things. But from God's perspective, he knows exactly how we're going to respond. He knows what's in the future. He's in control of future events. So in that sense, it's a lot less risky for him than it would be for those of us that are trying to raise children.
Could you speculate just a little bit? I know you're not God, but why did God create the bipedal primates that we're having the similarities with that's creating all this controversy?
Okay. The Bible never addresses the question why God created bipedal primates before Adam and Eve. Matter of fact, it doesn't even address the issue of bipedal primates, period. Probably because they're not important enough to be addressed. However, as I mentioned in this book, we have an anthropologist as part of our volunteer team who has offered this as an explanation. His explanation is, well, look at what we human beings have done to the birds and mammals on planet Earth in the last 30,000 years. Half the species of birds are now gone. There were 20,000. Today there's only 10,000. There were 30,000 species of land mammals. Today there's only 14,000. So we human beings in just 30,000 years have brought about the extinction of slightly more than half of all the bird and mammal species. Thank you very much. And so this anthropologist speculates as follows. God knew ahead of time that we human beings would sin in the Garden of Eden. He knew ahead of time that that sin would have devastating consequences on life on planet Earth, especially the advanced forms of life. And indeed, it's the most advanced life forms that have suffered the most at our hand. And so knowing all that, God said, I really want to try hard to give these birds and mammals a fighting chance. What I'm going to do is create a series of bipedal primate species that will help the birds and mammals to adapt for the coming future shock. Now, he admits, as I would admit, this is pure speculation. It's simply a good attempt at trying to explain why God would do this. God may have a far better reason. But I don't buy the reason that God was practicing.
No.
Yes.
You recently have been aware of the fact that and there's been publicity and writings on encoded words and statements in the Bible. I'm sure you know something
sure.
about that. I'm particularly interested in the claim that Yeshua is mentioned, and particularly in those verses that deal with the coming Messiah.
Okay. It's asking me to comment on the Bible code phenomena. And by the way, this is really going to pick up some steam. There's going to be a movie released, I think, October 16th. But the title code is in there. It's called the Omega Code. And it's put out by some well-funded evangelical Christians. It's going to have a theater release. And I've been asked to help promote this movie. But I'm going to have to keep quiet. Because the main plot of the movie is that somebody discovers this Omega Code in the Hebrew letters of the Old Testament and now knows exactly what God's going to be doing in fulfilling the Great Commission and bringing about the return of Jesus Christ, the tribulation. It's rather an exciting film. I got a little clip, and it's got lots of action in it. So, you know, my boys looked at it and said, Dad, we want to see this thing. And I said, well, you know, the plot line just isn't very biblical, but regardless. But it's kind of a carryover to something that's been plaguing the Christian community for the last 2 years. That if we look at the letters, the sequence of letters in the Hebrew Old Testament, there is an embedded code there, which will tell us a lot more about what God's planning to do than what we now know today. And if you go to our website, reasons.org, you'll find four papers we've posted there that deal with the Bible code. One is a piece that simply makes the point that the book of Colossians stresses in no uncertain terms that we Christians are not to listen to anyone that claims to have some secret hidden meaning for the church. The point that Paul makes in Colossians is that God reveals himself openly, clearly, and directly. He does not use esoteric means to reveal his truth to us. And if someone claims that they've got some hidden secret that they've dug out of the text that they alone are aware of, we're not to pay any attention to them. And the second paper we got posted up there is making the point that this claim of a secret code embedded in the Hebrew letters is mathematically flawed. The people who are making this claim, Michael Drosnin is probably the most famous, not a believer, but Jeffrey Grant is a Christian who's really promoted this big time. In fact, Jeffrey Grant's books are now the best-selling books. Jeffrey's. Thank you for correcting that. But yeah, I was told that his books have sold like a million copies. So it's by far and away the best-selling books on anything to do with evangelism, missions, apologetics, evidences for God, even ahead of C.S. Lewis. So, but the flaw is assuming that, well, there's only one variable to search over for the code, namely every 50th letter or every 49th letter. And the truth is that the people searching for these codes actually looked at every second letter, third letter, fourth letter, fifth letter, 60th letter, 100th letter. Sooner or later, you're going to score. Okay, you're going to find something. If the variable list over which you're searching is big enough, you're going to find what you're looking for. Point number three, all they've come up with so far is hindsight, not foresight. We predicted that, Rabin would be murdered? Yeah, but they didn't publish it until after the event took place. And therefore, it'd be rather easy to go through these Hebrew letters and search long enough until you come up with RBN. And I say RBN because the Hebrew language doesn't include vowels. Moreover, it doesn't even include the spaces between the words. And the fourth paper we got up on our website, written by Robert Newman, an astronomer who helps with our efforts, he has said that if you take the vowels out and the spaces between the letters, you can make even a small set of letters say anything you want. And he says, here's how I'm going to prove it. He took the Gettysburg Address. As you know, it's only a couple of pages. And he took out all the vowels, took out all the spaces between the words, and he got far more interesting messages out of that text than Michael Drosnin was able to draw from the whole book of Genesis. And his point is that if you take the spaces between the words, you don't even know how long the words are. Take the vowels out, and you can literally come up with anything you want in just the space of 100 words. So he says, this is completely mathematically flawed. And he says, if you don't believe me, give me any piece of literature, and I'll get you any code you want. So, yes.
In the search for planets or Earth-like planets, how valid is that research? There's something like 17 odd or whatever it is.
Yeah, they have now found 20 extrasolar planets. And how valid is it? Well, the technique is one of, let me get my briefcase here. Okay, pretend this is a star and this is a planet. And we know that two massive bodies attract one another. Okay, when it's oriented like this, the planet will be pulling on the star and move the star away from you. When it's on this side, it'll pull it towards you. And so what astronomers do, they can't see these planets. But they look at the star, and they look at the blue shifts and the red shifts and the light of that star, and that will tell them how massive a body is going around that star and what the orbit of the star is, how far it is away from the star. It'll even tell them how eccentric the orbit is, how elliptical that orbit would be. On the assumption that the planet and the star are in your direct line of sight. Okay, what if it's oriented like this and it's going around like this? And what you're going to be doing is underestimating the mass of the planet. And if it's oriented like this, it could be another star. And so what we're getting from this kind of analysis is we know that these objects orbiting about these stars can't be smaller than a certain mass. But we don't know what the upper limit is. And because we don't know the line of sight. But if you get enough of them, you could say statistically, at least some of them must be close to the lower limit. And by the way, this technique is only effective for picking up planets that are more massive than half the mass of Jupiter. If they're smaller than that, they simply won't jiggle the star enough for you to see them. But that means they've found 20. Now, all 20 orbit high metallicity stars. These are stars that have a lot of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. And therefore, the claim that planets are ubiquitous is not true. Only 2% of the stars have enough metals that they can produce planets. So 98% of the stars we see are non-candidates for planets. 2% would be candidates. Those 2% are all young stars. And the principle here is that the later a star forms in the history of the universe, the more metals it has from the ashes of dead stars to make planets. Well, in terms of drawing the conclusion, we have these 20 extra solar planets, therefore planets are common. No, they're not common. Therefore, life is common. No, wait a minute. We're only finding them on newborn stars. Okay? It took, what, 4 billion years for our solar system to have a situation where life would be possible on our planet? And therefore, these are not candidates. And probably the thing that's most significant is that these planets are nothing like the planets in our solar system. We're finding that these massive planets are orbiting nearby their stars. We used to think that of a massive planet formed, it would form just like Jupiter. Astronomers now realize through the discovery of extrasolar planets that Jupiter is a rare item in the universe. What's typical of a planet at the mass of Jupiter is that it will drift in towards its star. What causes a drift? If there's any dust in the solar system, when the giant planet forms, that giant planet will interact with the dust and drift inward. If it drifts inward, it will disturb the orbits of any planet like Earth with the capacity to support life. It only works if the giants don't drift. But the giants will only not drift if all the dust is gone by the time they form. And now that we've done our calculations over again, we've discovered it's really a rare instance when all the dust is gone by the time this thing forms. Jupiter is the exception, not the rule. The other thing they've found out is that these planets have highly eccentric orbits. Instead of a circle, it's like this. And if you have high ellipticity, then that again will disturb the orbit of any small planet going around that star. So these extrasolar planets are exposing just how well-designed our solar system is for life. It's the opposite of what you've been hearing in Time magazine. Yes?
What is the official evolution position on all the scientific discoveries over the years that pretty clearly show that innumerable things had to be happening simultaneously for life to first start and even to continue?
Hey, what's the position of evolutionists to all this new evidence that we have to have many different factors fine-tuned for life to be possible? Well, Fuzz Rana and myself did attend the International Origin of Life Conference held in San Diego in July. That conference is only held every 3 years, and it draws everybody who's involved in the origin of life. By the way, one of the things we noticed, we were the only creationists present. No other Christian organization had sent any delegates to that conference. We were the only ones. And a number of the participants there commented, and I said, well, we thought for sure a conference like this would draw Christians from all over. And they were rather astounded we were the only ones there. Nobody. We were it. Just us. The Young Earth creationists weren't there. The theistic evolutionists weren't there. We were the only ones present. But that conference really demonstrated just how desperate things are getting in the naturalist camp. The first two papers established once and for all that life did not originate on planet Earth if you're not going to appeal to a God. And that was kind of the way the whole conference was run. We all know there is no God, so let's figure out how life originated. And on that assumption, within 30 minutes, they drew the conclusion it could not have happened on planet Earth. And then the rest of the conference was spent on, well, that means it must have happened in outer space. Where can we find it in outer space? And then they tried to address the problem, or not address the problem. How do you get it from there to here? But the end of the conference, things were very depressing for the Origin of Life researchers because they realized, you know, the extreme conditions we need in outer space really don't exist. And more than that, there's no way to get the stuff from there to the Earth. So what do you do? Well, let's go back to square one. It happened on Earth, but not naturally. It must have happened supernaturally. And that's going on in several disciplines. People studying things like the Cambrian explosion or the event that wiped out the dinosaurs are also recognizing there's no possibility for a natural explanation. And a lot of them are becoming believers. You know, when I was on the faculty at Caltech, you could go into the biology research groups and maybe you'd run into 0.2% that would identify themselves as Christians. And the figures now run around 25 to 50%. You know, Lynn Carta was part of this class, and she was the one that told us, well, in her research group of 35 biologists, half of them would identify themselves as Christians. And we had another young man who was a part of this class, Gary Holt. And he says, well, my biology research group at Caltech is the worst. We only have 25%. But that's a huge advance over 20 years. Things have really changed. And I would give credit to that change to some of these discoveries. Yes?
To change the subject slightly, could you do a little description on the Hezekiah sundial?
Yeah, could I shed some light on Hezekiah's sundial? Well, you'll find this in Isaiah 37, 38, and 39. And now here's Isaiah getting really sick, or not Isaiah, pardon me, Hezekiah. King Hezekiah gets really sick. He's only 39 years old, and so he winds up going into his prayer closet. And he prays day and night for God to deliver them from this sickness. When God told him, look, Hezekiah, get your household in order. Well, Hezekiah prayed sufficiently that God said, I will grant your request and give you 15 more years. And as proof that I will do what I have said I will do for you, go out and look at your sundial and you'll watch the shadow of the sundial go back 10 steps. 10 steps translates into two-thirds of an hour. And so the shadow of the sundial went back 40 minutes. And Hezekiah looked at that shadow going back and saying, that's a miracle. Therefore, I think I'm going to get better. And indeed, he did get better and lived 15 more years. The most interesting part of that passage, however, is that the Babylonians saw the same event. They saw their sundial shadow go back by 40 minutes as well. And that's 600 miles away. And what I thought was interesting is that the Babylonians said, boy, we just saw a miracle. Let's go to the prophets of Marduk in downtown Babylon and see what's going on. They didn't do that. That didn't even cross their minds. They said, we're going to send a delegation to Jerusalem. Something of this nature can only be explained by the God of the Israelites. And so that kind of indicates that even in pagan Babylon and other pagan nations, there seemed to be the recognition that the one true God was the God of the Israelites. But what that tells us, we're looking at a miracle that must have encompassed a geographical area with a diameter of 600 miles. And in that case, I cannot think of any kind of meteorological event that could impose that kind of a shift in the shadow. I mean, if we were talking just downtown Jerusalem, you know, you could work out a scenario. But this is much larger than that. And therefore, I have suggested, we have a video on this, as well as a paper, that in that case, we would need to appeal to God performing some kind of miracle beyond the space-time envelope of the universe. Some have speculated that he shined a Shekinah glory from beyond space and time to make this happen. the standard explanation that God stopped the rotation of the Earth won't work, because that would have destroyed all life on the planet. So that didn't happen. The longer day, you don't need the same order of miracle. You could explain Joshua's long day by a local meteorological event. Exceptional, but hey, this is God performing a miracle. And he'd be working within the atmosphere of the planet to bring about either the extra darkness or the extra light. And that doesn't come through in the English translation. In the Hebrew, there's two ways to interpret the phrase. A day of extra light or a day of extra darkness. And it's really predicated on how you interpret the battle. Was it a hot day? And did Joshua need to have his troops cooled off? Or was it getting difficult to see the enemy? They needed the light to stay up so they could shoot their arrows accurately. Depends on your battle scenario what you'll come up with. But the text tells us it took place in the Valley of Ajalon. And my wife and I had a chance to see that area, and it's a region ringed by hills. Not very big. And therefore, you wouldn't need anything other than a fairly dramatic local meteorological event to bring about the effect. On the other hand, God could have used a Shekinah glory. It could have been the same kind of miracle as for Hezekiah's sundial. But I'll tell all of you this. The rumor that Jet Propulsion Laboratory physicists have proven Joshua's long day with their supercomputers is just that. It's a rumor. It's not true. The rumor has been persisting for 30 years. And the reason it's so persistent is that technically it could be done. On the assumption that astronomers in the days of Hezekiah and Joshua gave accurate recordings of their solar eclipse events. The truth is they did not. In the days before Joshua, you'd find the Egyptian astronomers recording, today a solar eclipse took place in our country. Well, today is not a very accurate timing, and in our country is not a very accurate geographical placement. If you had accurate geography and accurate timing, you could predict future solar eclipses. And you can compare it with future solar eclipses to see if there's a discrepancy. But the fallacy in all of this is that the ancients simply didn't measure their eclipses with enough precision. Myself, I've looked at the data for Hezekiah's sundial. There's a guy by the name of Alan Fotheringham who wrote a piece on it in 1922 in the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. Because at that time, they were recording their solar eclipses with a certain degree of precision. But it's not enough to confirm 40 minutes. The error bars are about plus or minus 10 minutes. It's close, but no cigar. We're out of time. Okay. Thank you.
Jeannie, do we have a date for December? December the 5th. Our next Skeptics Forum. I hope you found this enlightening. Glad you all came. Let's give a big thank you to Dr. Ross. You're all welcome next Sunday. Have a great afternoon. Thanks for coming.